I trust that you've had a blessed day. I know that I have. And it's good to be here in this assembly this evening as we, for the next few moments, consider things that, as we say from time to time, will have a direct impact upon the lives that we live here and certainly the lives that we hope to live in eternity. I'm going to be studying this evening from the 15th chapter of the Gospel of Luke. And so if you have a Bible with you or there's one handy to you, I invite you to open your Bibles to Luke chapter 15. That's really a chapter of lost things. You know, I recognize living in the culture that we live, lost is a word that sometimes evokes certain feelings of alarm or feelings of anxiety. Because usually we use the word lost in reference to something that's very valuable to us, maybe a family heirloom that is lost, and we know how that feeling is, or even something more tragic than that, a child lost in the woods or lost at the mall, and we really get concerned about that because it just invokes these feelings of anxiety and these feelings of fear. Well, in Luke chapter 15, Jesus tells the story, tells three stories of lost things. Now, two of the stories that he tells is probably not going to be very applicable to us. As a matter of fact, he tells about a man who had 100 sheep. And I doubt that there are any sheep herders in the assembly this evening. And so we could read about a man who lost a sheep. He has 99 that are safe over in the pasture, and he leaves those, and he goes looking diligently for that lost one because it's very precious and very valuable to him. But Jesus points out something. He says, you know what? When he finds that sheep, he wants his neighbors to rejoice with him. And he said, that's the way it is in heaven over a sinner who comes to the Lord. He said, the angels in heaven rejoice because that one that was lost is no longer lost. He's in a fold of safety. Then he tells about a woman who had 10 coins and she loses a coin. Probably as some of the commentators say about that, it's probably a woman's headdress that she had. It was decorated with coins, and one of those decorative coins is lost, and she sweeps the house diligently until she finds that coin. And then she rejoices because it was very precious and very valuable to her. She calls her neighbors and they rejoice with her. And again, Jesus makes the point. That's the way it is in heaven when a sinner repents. There's rejoicing in heaven. And so Jesus is really pointing out that this is how valuable that we are to the Lord. Now, the reason that Jesus told those two stories and the third one that we're going to examine this evening is because of what was said in the first two verses of Luke 15. Jesus was being criticized in those verses because he had the audacity to reach out and have any relationship, eating meals with and associating with those that the world would view as sinners. So they rebuked him and they looked down upon him because they said Jesus receives sinners and eats with them. Well, Jesus came into this world to seek and to save the lost, Luke 19 and verse 10. That's the purpose of his coming into the world. And when he was criticized over that, he said, let me explain this to you. Let me tell you what I'm doing here. It's just like this man that had 100 sheep or this woman who had 10 coins. But again, I point out that we don't really relate to that because a coin wouldn't be all that valuable to us today. And certainly a sheep, if we're not sheep herders, we don't recognize perhaps the value that that would mean to a shepherd. But then Jesus tells a third story. He tells about a man who lost a son. He didn't lose a son to death. He lost a son to the world. He tells that there was a man who had two sons. And these sons lived with his father on the farm. And, you know, everything was going well. But then one day that one son leaves. And he goes into a far country. So a man lost a son. Now, I tell you, we can relate to that because family relationships are very valuable to us. So when Jesus talks about losing a son, then our ears perk up and we become interested in that. But, you know, when we think about the word lost in reference to, you know, being in a relationship with God, sometimes we might view that as a word that is politically incorrect. In other words, we don't like to think of our children who separate from God, we don't like to think of them as being lost. Or if we have a child that tends to have some rebellious spirits about him or her, we don't really like to think about, I'm raising a child who is rebellious. Now, we kind of soften that up a little bit. We may say, well, he or she is immature. Or maybe he or she is irresponsible. Or we may think that they are just confused. And they'll get it all worked out one of these days. But I want to tell you something tonight. And I want you to listen to me. I'm going to have a lot to say about young people, but I'm going to have some things to say to all of us. Youthful rebellion is not immaturity. Youthful rebellion is not irresponsibility. Youthful rebellion is not being confused. It is just exactly what the word implies. It is rebellion. It is challenging the system. That's what rebellion is. It's challenging the system, whether it's a system of government, whether it's a system of family values, or whether we're talking about a system in relationship to God. The Bible teaches us in 1 Samuel chapter 15, insofar as Saul was concerned, when he rebelled against the commandments of God, Samuel reminded him that rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. So we're talking about that which is sin. So what we're going to do this evening is we're going to take the parable of the prodigal son, and we're going to break down the first half of that into 5 points. And I'll tell you where we're going to go with the story. And you can kind of see where we are as we begin reading the story. I'll have 5 points in our study this evening. I'm going to point out that the younger son, first, he comes to his father. That's point number one. Point number two, he comes to a far country. Point number three, while in that far country, he comes to be in need. Point number four, he comes to himself. And then the story is going to conclude with point number five. Now he comes to his father. He comes home. So if you have your Bibles handy and you know where we're going with this, I invite you to open them to Luke chapter 15. And we're going to begin reading, and we're going to take this in increments. We're going to look at it as a journey of a rebel. And we're going to look at the whole story of the prodigal son as we begin to examine his journey. Now, I know, let me say this at the outset. I know what the purpose of those parables are. But I'm going to look at this in a way that makes application to families and to family values and to family references. I'm going to look at it as a family in crises where a young son rebels against his father and perhaps his mother and leaves home. But let's begin now with point number one. He came to his father. Look at verse 11. Luke chapter 15, beginning at verse 11. Then he said, this is Jesus speaking, a certain man had 2 sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. So he, that is the father, divided to them his livelihood. Now, I want you to stop with me just a moment as I attempt to paint a word picture for you, and I want you to get the picture. Here is a man who obviously loves his 2 sons. And so the youngest boy comes to his father, and he says, you know, Dad, I want to talk to you about something. Now, wouldn't that thrill any dad? Wouldn't that thrill any parent? I know when my children were still at home, I longed to just sit down and talk with them. Sometimes they'd come in from a ball game or they'd come in from a date, and I'd be sitting there, and we'd sit at the table, maybe drink a glass of juice or a glass of Coke or something, and we'd just talk about the evening. I love that. But this boy didn't come to his father and say, I want to talk to you about my date. I want to talk to you about my, you know, going out tonight. I want to share with you some information about that. No, he came to his father, and basically he said to his dad, you know, Dad, I'm tired of living at home, and I can't wait for you to die, and I know when you die, I'm going to get an inheritance. And I tell you what, Dad, why don't you just give me that inheritance now so that I can leave? Those are the words that that father would have heard. When that boy came, said, give me my inheritance. You know, I'm leaving home. Now, I'm going to tell you, you can slice that and you can dice that and you can look at it in a lot of different ways, but the truth of the matter is that's rebellion. I don't want to live here anymore. I want you to just funnel some money to me that I would get when you die and let me leave home. That's rebellion. Now, today, young people may not say that. They may not come to their father or their mother and say something like that, but I'll tell you what they might say. They might come to a father and a mother, and they may say something like, you know what, when I get to be 18, you can rest assured I am gone. I didn't ask to be born in this family. I didn't ask to grow up in this family. And so, you know what, I'm tired of the rules, and I'm tired of the regulations, and I'm tired of somebody standing over me all the time telling me what I can and what I cannot do. And, Dad, let me tell you something. When I'm 18, I'm out of here. I'm gone. Now, that's rebellion, and that might be a 21st century application to what this boy did with his father. He comes to his dad, and he said, I want you to give me what I've got coming to me. I don't know what, I don't know the feelings that he had to his, about his parents. I don't know. But nevertheless, it was rebellion. I am leaving home. You know, somebody said one time that a young man came to his father and he said to his dad, he said, you know, Dad, you know, I just don't like the way things are around here anymore. And, you know, as a matter of fact, I didn't ask to be born in this family. And Daddy told him, said, no, you did not ask to be born in this family. And had you asked, I'd have said no. And I think some daddies kind of feel that way. But let me share something with you. Let me show you from Proverbs chapter 30. What God says, and this is very descriptive of rebellion. He says in Proverbs 30 and verse 11, there is a generation that curses its father and does not bless its mother. What does God say that needs to be done so that we may live long upon the earth? He said, honor your father and your mother, that it may be well with you and you will live long on the earth, Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6. But here he says, you know, there are some young people that don't respect their parents. There's some young people that are rebellious. They do not honor father and mother. Now notice what he goes on to say in verse 12. He said, there's a generation that is pure in its own eyes. They're self-deceived and they're self-serving. He said, yet is not washed from its filthiness. That is the filth of the world. Then he says there is a generation in verse 13. Oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up. That is, there are young people who just simply toss aside the mores and the morals of their parents. They just toss aside the values that they were raised with. Their eyes are lifted up. They know better than the generation that raised them. And so I'm not going to put up with this. I don't need to listen to your wisdom. I know as much as you do. But I want you to notice what he said in verse 17. He used some highly figurative language here to let us know if this is going to describe you, this is what you can expect. He said, the eye that mocks his father and scorns obedience to his mother, he said, the ravens of the valley will pick it out. And he said, the young eagles will eat it. What he says is, if this is going to be the way that you live, then you can expect to suffer the consequences of what you're choosing to do. And he said, your eyes will be plucked out. He's not talking literally here, but what he's saying is, you're going to reap what you sow. Be very careful. I tell people, you know, it is amazing to me, but do you realize that some of the greatest decisions that we make that has an impact upon us are made when we are young? It does. It is. It is amazing. When we are young, in our teens, our late teens, we decide where we're going to go to school, if we are going to school. We decide whether we're going to have a vocation or whether we're going to have a career. We make those decisions. We make decisions about who's going to be our spouse or our companion throughout the rest of our life. We make those decisions when we're young. And sadly, while we're young, we make some decisions that have such a negative impact upon us. As we said the other evening, we make choices that we cannot go back and undo. I held a meeting down in Central Kentucky. This has been a number of years ago. And prior to going down there and holding that meeting, one of the men in that congregation called me, and we were talking about the upcoming meeting, and he said to me, he said, "Brother J.R., he said, has anybody told you about Ben? B-E-N, a man named Ben." I said, "No, I don't think so. I can't think of anybody calling me and telling me about Ben." He said, I need to tell you about Ben before you get here." And so he shared with me the story of this man named Ben. Now, this little church building in this little community sat right on Main Street. And sidewalks that a lot of people used to go up and down Main Street went right in front of the church building. And I don't know, it was the second or the third night that I was there, and I was up preaching, and the foyer doors were closed, but suddenly they opened, and in walked Ben. And Ben come in, and he was all disheveled. His shirt was buttoned up, not straight. His face was dirty. His hair was a mess. And he come in, and he was mumbling something as he looked at me, and he's walking down the aisle. And, of course, everybody took their eyes off me and started looking at Ben, and I did the same. And I watched Ben. As the closer he got, I could tell that saliva was running down his cheek, and his collar of his shirt was wet from where he had slobbered on it, and he was uttering something, he was mumbling something, and he come in and he sat down on the front row there, and he lifts his hands up like that to me. I couldn't understand what he was saying. And finally, some of the brothers, they took him out and put him in a classroom and sat there with him for the rest of the service. You want to know what happened to Ben? When Ben was about 13 or 14 years old, at this time he was in his late 20s, when he was about 13 or 14 years old, he and some of his friends that he went to school with, they'd go down to the Ace Hardware store and they would steal cans of clear spray paint. And they'd go out behind the gymnasium in the local high school there, and they'd take an old dirty ball sock and they'd just fill it full of that paint, and they'd sit there and they'd huff that down into their lungs, and they would get high doing that, and that's something that they did on a consistent basis. And now Ben, in his late 20s, cannot string a sentence together. I don't know if when he's lifting up his arms, if he wanted a relationship with God or he just wanted me to do something for him. I have no idea, because you couldn't understand. You see, what's happening here, God will let us make decisions that will destroy our health, destroy our lives, and destroy our future if that's what we choose to do. Here is this boy who decided he's going to leave home. And God didn't reach down and keep him from doing that any more than God reached down and kept Ben from doing what he did. God will let us make choices that will destroy us if we choose to do that. This is why I get so disturbed when I see that young people are not paying any attention to what the older generation is saying. They're just throwing off those values. We're not trying to deprive anybody. We're not trying to make anybody unhappy. We're not trying to rein somebody in and make them slaves. Not at all. We're just simply saying, don't go down the road that Ben went down. But God will let you if that's the choice that you want to make. This boy said, "Dad, I'm leaving home." I don't know if he felt that he didn't, wasn't wanted. I don't know what went through his mind. I just know what he did. You know, the Bible tells us in Ecclesiastes 11 and verse 9 that in our youth we can live it up, but God said, you be careful, because all the things that you do will be brought into judgment one day. You will have to pay the piper. Now, before I go to point number 2, I want to say something I believe is extremely important out of the story pertaining to this boy's father. Now, I want you to just think about this dad. This dad's got his youngest son saying to him, "I'm going to leave home." Now, this dad, listen to me now. This boy, you know what he goes out and does? We'll talk about that in a moment. He goes out and he gets with harlots, and he's just living an immoral and an ungodly life. Now, I'm going to tell you something about this father that I admire and helped me when I was raising my children. This father, listen to me very carefully, this father did not amend his morals and his values in order to keep that rebellious young person at home. He did not. That is so important for us to think about. He didn't say to his son, "Oh, please don't leave home. You can, you know, whatever you want to do, you just bring it in here. You can do it at home." No. Daddy was not about to amend his values to keep a rebellious young person at home. No, not at all. This father understood what a lot of modern fathers don't understand. And that is, when one decides to rebel, he starts first in the mind or in the heart. You rebel right here in the head before you ever walk out the door. Now, what you notice now, it was a few days afterwards, according to verse 13, not many days after, that the boy finally left. But you see, he already left in his mind. And all the tears that you can cry, and all the pleadings that you can do, and all the begging that you can do to keep that young person at home will not work. And all the incentives that you offer and all of the compromises that you make will not change that rebellious spirit that started right up here in the mind. It won't change anything. This is why it is amazing to me. It is amazing to me that there are some parents, some Christian parents, who are willing to provide birth control devices for their sons and their daughters. Because they want, if they're going to do these things, at least to do it safely. You are amending godly values in order to keep rebellion under your roof. Don't do that. Don't be like some parents who say, "Well, I'll tell you what, Junior, if you're gonna drink, I'd rather you bring that into the house." No. No. "If you're going to commit fornication, let me get you a hotel room after the prom so that you can be in a safe environment." No. This father was not about to amend his values to keep a rebellious child at home, and no godly parent ought to do it either. I admire that about that father. Did it hurt him when his boy left? You betcha it did. That boy had to go. If he's going to live that way, you're not going to live that way under this roof. Now, I'll tell you something else about the father that I admire. I admire the fact that he let the boy go and suffer the consequences of his choices. I believe that father probably had the wherewithal that he could have sent a servant down and followed that boy. And he could have said to that servant, "Listen, he's leaving home, and I'm concerned about him. And I want you to go, and if you see Junior having some problems over here, why, make sure you slip him a little money. Bail him out. We don't want anything bad to happen to him." No, Daddy didn't do that. "You're going to leave home, and you're going to make these choices. You're going to suffer the consequences of the choices that you've made." I admire that in that father. You know, the Bible says that the way of the unfaithful is hard. And it is. And sometimes we just have to let them suffer the consequences of their decision. Now, we're going to come back to that in a moment. His father let him go and let him stand and fall on his own. He didn't bail him out. Did he worry about him? I'm sure that he did. Did he cry over him? We're not told, but I'm confident that he did. I know that he was looking down the road every day for his return. Did he pray for him? I'm sure that he did. But he let him go. So the boy came to his father. He takes off. The Bible says that he came to a far country. Notice verse 13. "And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and journeyed to a far country. And there wasted," that's what the word prodigal means, wasted. "And there wasted his possessions with prodigal," or wasteful, "living." Now look very carefully at verse 13 if you've got a Bible open. And I want you to see if you can see within that verse the name of the place where he went. Did he go to Athens, Greece? Did he go to Alexandria, Egypt? Did he go to Babylon? Did he go to Sodom? Where did he go? Well, you say, "Well, J.R., it's not told." No, it is. God doesn't say that he went to this country, he went to that. God said he went to a far country. Now, I think that's interesting. Because I tell people today, you know what? You don't have to go to New York. You don't have to go to Los Angeles. You don't have to go to New Orleans. You don't have to go to Paris, France, or London, England, or Amsterdam, Holland. You don't have to go to those places to be in a far country. You can be in a far country right here in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, or wherever it is you live. You can be in a far country. Somebody said, well, J.R., how's that possible? You remember what Jesus said in Matthew 15 and verse 8? He said, they honor me with their lips, but their hearts are what? Their hearts are far from me. You see, God doesn't measure a far country geographically on a map. God measures a far country in how far we've gone from God. That's a far country. And there are a lot of young people who have good parents and godly grandparents who come to church services every time the doors are opened, able to memorize the apostles and the prophets and able to memorize the judges and tell you which judge was this way and which judge was that way. But I'll tell you what, they're in a far country. Their hearts a long time ago have drifted away from the Lord. Oh, they may be at every service. But their hearts... I teach Bible classes of young people. I love dealing with young people. I love interacting with young people. But I'll tell you one of the things that I noticed a number of years ago. I began to read body language. Now, I'm not like some of these people on television. You tell you what somebody's saying and doing, what they're thinking. That's not what I mean. But I can read the body language of young people when I'm teaching them. Sometimes they're sitting there as though they don't have a spine. They just kind of flop down in the chair like that. They're not paying any attention. And I can see when the eyes are rolled when I say something, and I can see when the head is shaking. I see all of that. And what I'm able to determine is, you know what? This person, if he or she hasn't already left, this person is almost in a far country. And I think parents and I think grandparents ought to become more astute at reading body language because they are in a far country. Now, it may not show up until they go off to college. And then suddenly we find out they're not going to church. It may not show up until they get a job across town and get an apartment. And suddenly they're doing things that I can't believe he's doing what he's doing. Well, you see, that person was in a far country before they left home. And leaving home just brought that to the surface. If I were to render a guess as to the name of a far country that someone had gone into, I would call that far country liberty or freedom. Because very often what a rebel desires is to have freedom, have the restraints taken away, and be able to make all the decisions and not have anybody standing over them, telling them what they can do, what they cannot do, and I just want the freedom to do all of that myself. But you know, that's desirable, believe me. I wasn't born full grown. I know the feelings about that. But that's just impossible to live that way. What would you think of me if I told you after services tonight, you know, I've been studying about this, and man, I'm going to tell you something. I'm just tired of living under the law of gravity. And I'm not going to do it anymore. I just absolutely refuse to do it. So I go downtown and I find the tallest building that I can find. I get up on the roof of it and I say, I'm going to show you what I'm going to do. I'm going to defy gravity because I'm tired of living under the restrictions of gravity. And I step off. You know what's going to happen? You can't live and defy the laws of gravity, the laws of sanitation. You cannot do it. You cannot live and defy the laws of God without destroying yourself in the process. Listen to what Peter said. In 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 18, verse 19, he said, and I know he's talking about false teachers here, but let's make the application. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by whom a person is overcome, by him also he is brought into bondage. You see that? You can be brought into bondage. Paul calls that in Romans 6 and verse 12, having sin reign in your mortal body. Let me tell you something. I've shared with you, and I do this not because I'm proud of my past, but because I'm so thankful to God that I'm no longer living in my past. But when we were children, growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, we'd go down. I had some relatives that had, we called it a camp. It was just a house down by the river that we'd go down, and the adults would sit around drinking beer, playing horseshoes, and playing pinochle. And we kids, we'd swim in the Ohio River or find a cane break somewhere and make us some, hideouts and such things as this. But what we learned to do something as we got a little bit older. We learned that after the adults had drank enough beer, they weren't really paying a lot of attention to us kids. And we had, they'd always bring soft drinks for us, and they'd bring Orange Crush. And so we'd take an Orange Crush bottle, and, they used to be brown. Maybe they still are. I don't know. And we'd pour that out, and we'd kind of rinse it out, and when the adults weren't looking, we'd go over in their cooler, and we'd take a beer out of that. And then we'd run off somewhere, and we'd open it up, and we'd pour that beer into that Orange Crush bottle. And we thought, man, we are pulling one over on the adults. This is cool. This is neat. And that's exactly what we did. And we thought it was a fine thing. My cousins and I and my sister and I would do that. My sister didn't handle that like I did. My sister, who was 2 years younger than me, became an alcoholic. She ended up having 5 children and giving all but 4 up for adoption. She was in and out of rehab, in and out of jail. My sister lived an ungodly and immoral life. And it all started when we thought how cool and neat it was to be able to drink beer in front of the adults. When I was living in North Middle Tennessee, living near Nashville, Tennessee, I got word that my sister had been diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver. I had no idea where she had been for the last 20 years. I finally made contact with her. I found her in a hospital in Kentucky. And after she got out of the hospital, I knew a fellow that had a rehabilitation center in Kingston Springs, Tennessee. And so I enrolled my sister in a rehab center. And I was with her, and she was sitting there across from a lady that was checking her in, and I stood there by my sister. And the lady was taking all the information from my sister, and she said to my sister, she said, "Mrs. Kennedy," that was her married name, "Mrs. Kennedy, what is it you drink?" My sister dropped her head down. Then she looked up at me as I was standing there, and she said very sheepishly, she said, "Ma'am, I drink anything I can get my hands on, anything that will give me a buzz, and that includes rubbing alcohol. I'm going to tell you something. You don't know bondage. Bondage is not when somebody's trying to keep a person from doing the things that's going to destroy them. Bondage is when sin begins to reign in your mortal bodies." I was crushed to hear something like that, knowing that perhaps some of the choices that I had made had in some way contributed to that. You don't know sin until it begins to get a hold of you and you can't let go of it. It's got a death grip upon you. She passed away from liver cancer directly associated with her alcoholism. This boy comes to his father. Then he comes to a far country, and we pick up our reading again, this time in verse 14, because now some changes are taking place. He came to be in need. "But when he had spent all, there arose a severe famine in that land, and he began to be in want. Then he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into the field to feed swine. And he would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything." Now, I want you to just stop and look at this scenario for just a moment. Here he was down there. He come down there with a whole pocket full of money, spending his money, wasting his money, getting all these things going, And now when the money runs out, the friends run out. They're gone. Nobody cared for him. They didn't care anything for him. Back when we were living down in Tennessee, my son got a job in an apartment complex when he was 15 years old. And he was, emptying garbage, and he was cleaning out the pool and things like this, and making some pretty good money for a 15-year-old kid. And there was a guy at church, and so, he kind of rebuilt cars, and he sold cars, and my son got his permit, and he was about to get his license, and he said, "Dad, Joe's got a Volkswagen for sale, and I really want to buy that Volkswagen." Dad, please, I really, really, really want to buy that Volkswagen. And so he had the money to buy it. He's paying his insurance. He got his license. He's paying his insurance. And I'll tell you, what's really interesting about that, I was telling my wife one time, I said, I didn't know you'd get that many kids in a Volkswagen. Because I could hear that little Volkswagen putting through the neighborhood, and Dwayne and all of his buddies are coming up out of the house, and that car was just loaded down. They'd pile out of that, and they'd play basketball, and then after that, they'd pile back in it, and they'd go up to Dairy Queen and get some ice cream, and school started. And he kind of wanted to keep this up. And I asked him one day, I said, "Boy," I said, "don't you have any homework?" "Oh, Dad, they didn't give me any homework, and anytime they give me homework, I get it done at school." I said, "Well, let me tell you something. I'm going to tell you this right now. If, this is back before you could check the grades and so forth online. Isn't that a wonderful thing?" "Oh, boy, that's fantastic." But anyway, I told him, I said, "Well, here's the deal." I said, "If your grades are not what they ought to be when the grade cards come out," I said, "you're going to park at Volkswagen." And one day, I come in the office, and there's Dwayne sitting at the table. And he's all down in the mouth, and he just looks like he had lost his best friend. I said, "Boy, what's the matter with you?" And he stands up and looks at me. He hands me his grade cards and his keys. And we park at Volkswagen. But now, the point of the story is, hey, guess what? The phone quit ringing. The kids quit coming. There was no more trips to Dairy Queen. And you know the reason why? Because the only reason they were there in the first place is to get in that little red Volkswagen and drive all over Hendersonville, Tennessee. And when the reason for being there was parked in the driveway, they stopped coming. Do you see where I'm going with this? When this boy's money ran out, the people had no use for him. And this is one thing that I try to get young people to see. And parents, we need to impress this upon them. Grandparents, we need to help the parents do this. That the people in the world whom they believe to be the best and the dearest friends they'll ever have, "Dad, you don't understand. He's my friend. Mom, you don't understand. She is my best friend forever. You don't understand." Yes, we do. And I'll tell you, they don't care about you like your parents care about you. They don't care about you like people with whom you worship care about you. They're out to get what? Let me give you a for instance on this. Let's suppose that a young person begins to use tobacco products, maybe smokeless tobacco, snuff, or, just puts a pinch in there, and a lot of young guys, athletes do that, thinking it's cool, thinking that, hey, listen, you do that and maybe you get oral cancer. Maybe now cancer is eating away at your gum or your cheek. Or maybe you smoke and your esophagus is now eat up with cancer. Let me tell you something. R.J. Reynolds or Philip Morris is not going to pay a dime to help you. And the people who introduced you to that is not going to help you because they don't care about you. It's mom and dad that puts the bill. And maybe you know where to get drugs, or you know where to get alcohol. And you get out here on the highway. Maybe you get out on Highway 15 out here and you wrap your car around the tree because you went to the place where you could buy the beer or you could buy the vodka or whatever. Well, do you think the bootlegger that sold it to you is going to do anything to help you? No, it's mom and it's dad. You get busted for drugs. Do you think the person that introduced you to that's going to go to court with you and say, "Hey, listen, don't blame her. I got her." No, they don't care. The Bible says that nobody gave this man anything. They didn't care about him. Had a grandson. And when he was born, he had some lung problems, and they had to put him in the neonatal care of Riley Hospital in Indianapolis. An excellent facility. And I was down there with my daughter one day visiting, and he was in a little incubator. My daughter said, "Dad, look, you see that girl standing down there?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "She's 17 years old, and she gave birth to that baby that she's looking at." said the man that she was with was about 19 or 20 years old, and he had promised her, "I love you. I'm going to be with you forever. Nobody understands you like I understand you. Nobody's ever loved you like I love you. Nobody's ever experienced these feelings like we have for one another." And so she slept with him. She was pregnant. He promised to be with her for the rest of her life. She gave birth to that baby, and that baby was a Down syndrome baby. And he comes in and he looks at that child. He says, "Whoa, I can't handle this. I'm out of here." Now, I'll tell you who's going to handle this. It's going to be this girl and her mama and her dad. Because the reason for his caring for her has changed. This is the way it is in the world. This is what we need to recognize and we need to understand. That it's the foolish son who brings grief, not to his friends, but he brings grief to his mother. Now, after finding himself in need, he comes to himself. Let's pick up our reading again, this time verse 17. "But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father and will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. And I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" Now, before you lift your eyes off the Bible, go back to verse 17. That begins with, "But he came to himself." Let me ask you, and I'm not looking for an audible answer, but I want to challenge your thinking a little bit this evening. Why did that boy come to himself? Well, you know, the stock answer is, well, J.R., he got about as low as a man could go. I mean, he's there in a pigsty. And for a Jewish boy feeding hogs, man, you talk about that's not kosher. Now, he couldn't have got any lower. And so when you get as low as you can go, you come to yourself. You know, I like your answer if that's what you were thinking, but you are wrong. That's not why. There's a lot of people that get on Skid Row. There are a lot of people that get as low as they can go, and they never climb out of the pig pen they find themselves in. And, you know, our government needs to understand that sometimes when they think they're helping these people, they are harming these people. If you want to know why he came to himself, look at the bottom of verse 16. "No one gave him anything." And when you stop enabling sinful behavior, that person has nothing else to do but come to himself and make a change. Parents need to understand that. Grandparents need to understand that. Society needs to understand that. I had a friend that ran the rehab center in Kingston Springs, Tennessee, that I was talking about earlier. He himself was a recovering alcoholic. And here's what he and his wife told Sue and me sitting in our living room one day. He said, "You know what? I got thrown in jail so many times in Davidson County, Tennessee, that I couldn't count them." He said, "And every time that I got thrown in jail, so after I sobered up, I'd call my wife and she'd come down and she'd bail me out of jail, and I promised I was going to quit, and it just the cycle just over and over and over." He said, "One day I called her up. And I said, 'Well, I'm down here in the lockup again.' And she said, 'Harold, I want you to know I love you, but I'm not coming to get you out another time. You got yourself in, you're going to have to get yourself out.'" He said that was a kick in the gut. And he said, "Until we stop enabling bad behavior, until we stop enabling alcoholism, until we stop enabling rebellion, a person will not change. He will not come to himself." "Oh, but I love him." Stop it. "Oh, but I don't want him to be hurt." Stop it. You want them to come to themselves, or you want to enable that behavior for the rest of their short life? This boy had nobody. Nobody was going to bail him out. He came to himself. That's a turning point in his life. I'd like to share with you this story. When Sue and I became Christians in Louisville, Kentucky, years ago, we were worshiping with a congregation of about 220, 230 people. And the singing was absolutely beautiful. It really was. And there was one young woman in particular who had a very high soprano voice. And you could hear her when she would hit that high soprano, she would just reverberate all over the auditorium. It was beautiful. She not only did her brethren recognize that, but society recognized it as well, and she won a music scholarship up in the Northeast. And we had a going-away party for her, had a potluck over at the park, and off she went. We was all really proud of her. And off she went. Now, this is back in the day, no email, no cell phones. And so she would write back and forth to her parents, and suddenly the letters stopped coming. Her mom and dad became concerned, and they called up, called to the dorm, and they told her, told her parents when they called the dorm, she's dropped out of school. She's not here. Parents had no idea where she was. And we had prayer for her at church. We didn't know where. We even took up some money and sent a preacher up there to see if he could locate her. Nobody seemed to know where she was. We couldn't find her. Now, what I'm about to tell you now, we found out later. When she went up there, here's the thing about that. She came from good parents. Good parents. And she was raised coming to church all her life. She was like us. She's not somebody from a bad part of town that just reverberated back to the bad that she was used to. No. Good girl. But she got introduced to drugs. That led eventually to heroin use. She maxed out any credit cards that she had, spent all the money that she had, sold everything that she had to raise money to meet her addiction. The only thing that she had left to sell was her body. She became a prostitute. She got a pimp, or a pimp got her. She'd go out every night, sell her body. One time she slipped up and even got pregnant. Pimp beat her and made her have an abortion, and she did. One night she was getting ready to go out and walk the streets again. She was putting on her lipstick and her eye makeup and her short skirt and her spider stockings and her high heels, and she was getting ready to go out again. And she got to thinking about home. She got to crying. And she decided, I don't know if mom and dad will have me, but I'm going to go back home if they'll have me. And so she wiped her makeup off and she changed her clothes, and she got what little clothes that she felt was fitting to get, and she put them in a grocery sack, and she called a cab. And finally the cab come, and he's sitting out there just blowing his horn, and she went out, got in the cab. The cab driver could see that she was upset, and he got to talking to her, and she explained that she was a streetwalker. She was going home, going back to Louisville. He heard her story, and he drove her to the bus station. And he said to her, when she got to the bus station, you sit right here a minute, I'll be right back. And he went out at his own expense, and he bought her a one-way ticket on the Greyhound bus to Louisville, Kentucky. He waited there until she left on that bus. And the last thing he told her is, don't ever come back to this city again. And she went home. And I can tell you, she got her life right. And she is a good woman, a good mother, a faithful Christian this day. But she came to herself. This boy came to himself. What we need, we don't need, you know, rehabilitation, and we don't need all of these other things that people are trying to do for people who are in this kind of condition. What needs to be, what our young people need, and what our addicts need, and what those who are dependent upon drugs and other things need, they need rehabilitation in Christ. We need redemption by the blood of Christ. We don't need bigger and better pig pens. We need Jesus. This boy made a change. He said, I'm going home if Daddy will have me. And if Daddy don't want me to live with him, I'll work in the barn. I'll muck out the stalls. I'll do whatever Daddy wants me to do. But I'm coming home. And that's where the story of the prodigal. I know the older brother story. But this is where the prodigal brother story ends. He came back home. Let's look at verse 20. And he arose and came to his father. But when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they begin to be merry. The journey is over. He's back home. And just look at the love and the festivity and the warmth of that relationship. And I want you to notice something that's very interesting. When this boy came back home, he had mentally rehearsed what he was going to say. And he said exactly that. He said, Dad, I have sinned. He didn't in any way, shape, manner, or form try to whitewash that. He didn't say, well, I tell you what, Dad, everybody makes mistakes. No. He didn't say, well, I tell you, Dad, everybody sins. No, he didn't say that. He didn't say, Dad, I'm no worse than my older brother over here. No, he didn't say that. And he didn't say, Dad, I tell you what, you made a lot of mistakes yourself, and if you'd have been a better dad, I'd have never. He didn't do that. He owned it. He said, I have sinned. He took responsibility. And notice what the father didn't do. The father didn't say to him, son, how do you have the gall to come in here? After what you have done and after how you've shamed this family and you have drug our name through the mud and look at the hurt that you brought upon your mother, how dare you come? No, daddy didn't say that. He said, welcome home, son. You come on back and everything will be fine. And that's exactly what happened. Don't you see, there is just so much in this story. He came back to his father. Rebellion, ladies and gentlemen, is its own reward. Alienation from those who love us and alienation from God. It just may be, as someone tonight, you haven't gone to Amsterdam, you haven't gone to Paris, but maybe you have found yourself in a far country. You have honored the Lord with your lips, but not your life. Your heart is far from you. We're going to stand and sing an invitation song. And as we sing that song, let me tell you, God is calling tonight the prodigal home. You know, the Bible tells us of another prodigal in the Old Testament. That prodigal was Samson. Samson died. He didn't make it back the way this boy did. And so I tell people, if you're going to rebel against God and you're going to rebel against home, you've got a 50-50 chance of dying in your sins. So why don't you respond this evening if you find yourself as a prodigal? Because God is indeed calling the prodigal home. If you need to obey the gospel, be baptized in water for the remission of your sins, now's the time to do that while you're thinking about it, while your heart has been moved by the teaching of God's word. Or maybe as an erring Christian, you need to really get serious and come home to the Lord and do so tonight. Why don't you come, prodigal, as together we stand and as we sing.